It's Monday, January 6, 2014. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. This first Monday of 2014 is going to be a cold day, leading into an even colder evening and night. The National Weather Service predicts that the temperatures in many parts of the country, including not only the nation's heartland, but even into the deep south, could reach a temperature of zero or even below. Even by Saturday, one town in Vermont was registering 30 degrees below zero. One town in Maine, 36 degrees below zero. And the National Weather Service predicts that on Monday and Monday night, the temperatures could drop into similar territory in places like International Falls, Minnesota, where the prediction is 31 degrees below zero. In Fargo, North Dakota, it's going to be 31. 15 below in both Indianapolis and Chicago, and zero or below in places that hardly ever see that kind of temperature, ranging from central Kentucky to much of Alabama and the state of Georgia. Wind chill factors may be the most dangerous of all. The National Weather Service says that wind chills of 50, 60, or 70 below zero are possible in large sectors of the United States mainland. What does all this tell us? It reminds us just how small we are, how little control we have. There is no thermostat outdoors. That is entirely under God's control, and all we can do is deal with it. We can complain about the weather, and increasingly we can predict it. We can model it, but we cannot control it. We need also to remember those prayerfully for whom the cold will not be an inconvenience, but a very real challenge, and perhaps even a threat. Concern about the weather and public safety have led to massive closings of schools and other institutions across much of the country. And finally, brace yourselves for a good bit of ideological commentary on what this weather system supposedly says about climate change and global warming. What does it actually say? Probably very little. This probably doesn't add anything to either side of the argument. What it does tell us is that weather records exist to be broken, and they are broken routinely. And even as the Weather Service and others point to the fact that this is a very unusual weather system, even as certain records may be broken in certain locales across the country, the reality is it's going to be really cold today and tonight and into tomorrow. Colder than it was yesterday and probably colder than it will be by the end of the week. It will be this cold again one day, even as it was this cold at some point in the past. And while we're amazed at the weather, let's remember to be amazed at the weather as a facet of God's creation. As the psalmist would remind us, even the cold front is declaring the glory of God. That's something to think about as you bundle up on this very cold Monday. There is so much for us to cover and to think about as we look at the end of 2013 and the beginning of the year 2014. But several very crucial developments did take place over the last several days, and many of them were dated January 1, 2014. For example, it was on January the 1st that the Boy Scouts of America's official policy change on the issue of gay scouts went into effect. Effective on January 1, scouts who are openly gay can continue to participate in scouting, but they cannot be leaders. In anticipation of that date, the Boy Scouts of America released a very complicated set of principles and guidelines for troops to use in considering the change, the policy, and the issue. A closer look at those principles and guidelines for scouting units demonstrates the truth of what we knew all along. This represents a fundamental change in the character of the Boy Scouts of America, one of the United States' most venerable institutions. The change in the Boy Scouts of America, even the transformation of the Boy Scouts of America as an organization, is a profound part of the great moral revolution we are currently experiencing in this country. The Boy Scouts have been targeted for years, and in May, the national organization decided to change its policy. It announced the change in that policy. Shortly thereafter, a large number of churches and denominations announced that they would be withdrawing from scouting, or at least looking very closely at what this change would represent. The developments of the last several days are not likely to encourage those denominations that decided to stay. It's also easy to predict where this is going. The Boy Scouts of America in May adopted a policy that allows for openly gay boys as scouts, but not for openly gay scouting leaders. That doesn't please the New York Times, as you might expect. In an editorial entitled Scouting's Incomplete Evolution, the editors of the paper last Friday wrote, "The new year brings a positive change in the membership practices of the Boy Scouts of America." But the editorial went on to state, quote, "Unfortunately, the organization still refuses to fully renounce discrimination and will continue to prohibit gay and lesbian adults from serving as troop leaders." They went on to say, quote, This will perpetuate the idea that gays are inferior and that being gay is inconsistent with the Boy Scout values, a strong moral character, and leadership. It also means, they said, that gay youngsters who excel as scouts will be denied the chance to serve as pack or troop leaders when they turn 18. End quote. Well, of course, that's the fact. That's the policy that was adopted in May, and of course, it is a policy that will not stand. It is one of these very complicated, cumbersome, and unworkable policies that says that the Boy Scouts will no longer discriminate on the basis of the boys who are members, but will in terms of the leaders. Now, remember that the Boy Scouts of America here openly caved to pressure from those who were claiming that the group discriminates. The group still discriminates, this time on leadership, if not on membership. And as this editorial in the New York Times makes clear, those who were displeased with the Scouts before are still displeased with the new policy the Scouts began on January the 1st. The clear prediction is very easy to make. This new policy will not stand for long. In short order, the Boy Scouts will have to bring their leadership policy in line with their membership policy, and there will be gay scout leaders as well as gay scouts. Meanwhile, in the city of New York, Democratic liberal Bill de Blasio was sworn in as the city's mayor, ending over 20 years of Republican or independent dominance of the mayoralty there. Just about everyone in New York and elsewhere points to the election of Bill de Blasio as New York's mayor as a significant shift to the left, the political and ideological left. As Michael Greenbaum of the New York Times reports, Bill de Blasio, whose fiery populism propelled his rise from an obscure neighborhood official to the 100th mayor of New York, was sworn into office pledging that his ambition for a more humane and equal metropolis would remain undimmed. He goes on to report that in the mayor's inaugural address, he described social inequality as a quiet crisis on a par with other urban cataclysms of New York's last half century, from fiscal collapse to crime waves to terrorist attacks. And the new mayor insisted that income disparity was a struggle no less urgent to confront. In the words of the new mayor, quote, "We are called to put an end to economic and social inequalities that threaten to unravel the city we love." But even as the mayor was uttering those words, even some of his closest allies wondered aloud how exactly the mayor of New York could try to resolve such an issue. One of the interesting ironies in this is that, of course, the new mayor of New York has been elected mayor of a city that itself represents the kind of income inequality he says he wants to eliminate. And the policies to which he has committed himself are likely to lead to a further alienation of the middle class from New York. And it is the disappearance of the middle class, fast leaving New York and having to settle elsewhere, that really offers the statistical evidence for the income inequality that he identifies as the problem. You cannot have a resolution to the problem of income inequality or disparity without a massive and growing and thriving middle class. But the new mayor of New York is a big government liberal, and it's going to be very interesting to see if his election is a harbinger of other things to come. Many political analysts across the spectrum have pointed to the fact that the interesting development in national politics right now is the significant shift to the left on the side of the Democratic Party. This shift to the left is indicated not only by the election of Bill de Blasio as mayor of New York, but also by the election of Elizabeth Warren as the Democratic senator from the state of Massachusetts. Writing in its editorial column at the Washington Post, E.J. Dionne, also a man of the left, celebrates this shift in the Democratic Party and suggests, of all things, quite counterintuitively and unconvincingly, that this should be good news to Democratic centrists. Why? Because it shifts the entire political argument, he says, to the left. It's very hard to imagine how this can be read as good news for supposed moderates and centrists in the Democratic Party. As a matter of fact, one of the interesting things this now sets up is the race for the 2016 Democratic presidential nomination. This much is already clear. When you have people on the Democratic left complaining that President Obama is simply too conservative, that sets up a very interesting ideological contest. Also on January the 1st, marijuana, identified as recreational marijuana, as opposed to supposedly medical marijuana, went on sale to the general public 21 years of age and older in the state of Colorado. The most revealing article on this was the front page article that appeared last Thursday in the New York Times. The article by Jack Healy begins, quote, "They lined up before dawn and in the snow on Wednesday, baby boomers from Nebraska, retirees from Denver, and a young man who had driven all day from Ohio. Some were longtime marijuana users. Some had been arrested for marijuana possession. They were," says Jack Healy, "among the hundreds of tourists and residents across Colorado who eagerly took part in the country's first ever sales of state-regulated recreational marijuana. They walked into 40 shops from downtown Denver to snowy ski resorts, flashed their identifications, and in a single transaction took part in what supporters hailed as a historic departure from drug laws focused on punishment and prohibition." The quotes in this article are really interesting. A woman named Linda Walmsley said, quote, "It makes you giddy to say it. I went into a store and bought pot," end quote. Later in the article we read, quote, "Kristen Naus, 24, flew here from Chicago with her husband Tristan to take her first marijuana vacation. And she said the couple would smoke their marijuana at the home of a cousin. She said that she suffered from seizures and fibromyalgia and her husband from post-traumatic stress, but that they had not been able to get medical marijuana at home. When Colorado opened sales to out-of-state residents, she said they leapt at the chance. Quote, this is our dream. We're thinking about moving here because of it," end quote. As with the Boy Scouts and their complicated new guidelines on the issue of gay scouts, the issue of the marijuana legalization in Colorado led to a flurry of legislative energy. After all, the state had to come up with a set of laws to regulate the sale and use of marijuana. Again, supposedly recreational marijuana. Can teenagers get it? Well, the state of Colorado says no. But as even the local media indicated, the state of Colorado says they can't get a hold of alcohol either. That's hardly the case. Given the already liberal marijuana laws in the state of Colorado, it is now documented that the average teenager's first smoke in that state is not tobacco, but marijuana. And keep in mind the statistic that we've mentioned often. There are now more medical marijuana dispensaries in the state of Colorado, and particularly in the city of Denver, than there are Starbucks and McDonald's locations combined. As of January the 1st, any Colorado resident 21 years of age or older can buy up to an ounce of marijuana if they buy it from one of the legal dispensaries and if they pay the taxes that are now assigned to the sale of legal marijuana. And it gets very complicated after that. Can you own marijuana plants? Evidently, yes, in Colorado, but only up to 6, and they have to be under some kind of secure capture. Last year, the citizens of Colorado passed a constitutional amendment legalizing recreational marijuana, and as the Wall Street Journal announced in an editorial published last Friday, other states are now going to have a living laboratory they can watch in terms of what legal marijuana actually means. As the editors wrote, low prices, advertising, the perseverance of the underground marijuana economy, and the general social normalization of marijuana will naturally encourage more consumption, which carries troubling implications for young people and problem users who smoke all the time. States ought to monitor changes in Colorado's rates of marijuana-related crime, said the Wall Street Journal, and delinquency, teenage use, drug dependence and addiction, and accidents on the roads or ski slopes. Some adults might seem to be able to smoke responsibly, but like alcohol, the effects of pot on the juvenile brain are not benign, end quote. As a matter of fact, the American Medical Association had come out against the legalization of recreational marijuana with a particular warning about the effects of marijuana on the adolescent brain. But the citizens of Colorado cast that aside, determined to liberalize their laws on marijuana in what, along with the growing acceptance of same-sex marriage and homosexuality, amounts to a massive moral shift in our times. The date on one very significant moment and turning point in that shift will go down as January 1, 2014, and the location, the state of Colorado. As Jacob Gershman of the Wall Street Journal points out, other states will be watching very closely. He cites Thomas Jefferson School of Law professor Alex Crite, who said, quote, "I suspect we'll look back at 2014 as the year where we found out whether marijuana legalization became an inevitability or just a blip on the radar," end quote. Well, the professor didn't have to wait long. Yesterday's edition of the New York Times included this headline, "New York State is set to loosen marijuana laws." As Suzanne Craig and Jesse McKinley report, the shift in New York is being driven by Governor Andrew Cuomo, identified as a Democrat who had long resisted legalizing medical marijuana. But, as the reporters say, this comes as other states are taking increasingly liberal positions on it, most notably Colorado, where thousands have flocked to buy the drug for recreational use since it became legal on the first day of the year. Mr. Cuomo's plan, they say, will be far more restrictive, but for the state of New York, a state of massive population, is going to be a very significant shift towards the legalization of marijuana. As the analysis in the New York Times makes very clear, this puts the state of New York, one of the most populous states in the union, on the trajectory towards the increased progressive legalization of marijuana, not only for medical use, but for other uses as well. Finally, looking at the issue of marijuana, it's worth looking at an opinion column that appeared on January the 3rd, also in the pages of the New York Times. Editorial columnist David Brooks, often identified as a conservative, but a very moderate conservative at best, writes a column entitled, "Weed Been There, Done That." He writes about the fact that in his teenage years he used marijuana, but along with his friends, he says, he grew out of it. Not because of the law, not even because of peer pressure, but because of other interests, and the fact that evidently marijuana just wasn't that enticing to him. But he also registers very severe concerns about the liberalization of marijuana laws. He concludes his column by writing, "In legalizing weed, citizens of Colorado are, indeed, enhancing individual freedom. But they are also nurturing a moral ecology in which it is a bit harder to be the sort of person most of us want to be." End quote. I mention that statement simply because it is such an ineffectual moral argument. If all you can do is argue that something isn't good for the general moral ecology to encourage people to be all that they should, or at least should want to be, it's a very weak argument. If you abandon the categories of right and wrong, trying a new category of moral ecology is not going to hold. Finally, many of the nation's leading newspapers reported yesterday that the Marine Corps is considering changing its anticipated plan and policy for the requirements for women to serve in combat. As Reuters reported, after more than half of last year's female Marine recruits were unable to do at least 3 pull-ups, the Corps announced it will delay the new requirement for women to graduate from boot camp. Reuters goes on to report, the Marine Corps announced in November that starting January 1, all women would have to perform 3 pull-ups as part of their physical fitness test, something male recruits were already required to do as a minimum. To collect data on potential success, female recruits in 2013 were given the option to do pull-ups during the test. About 55% of female recruits in training at Parris Island, South Carolina, were unable to meet the challenge. The Marines, in response to this, said that they, quote, have no intent to introduce a standard that would negatively affect the current status of female Marines, end quote. Keep in mind, this came after all the assurances we were given in recent months and over the past year that the full inclusion of women in combat would not require the lowering of physical fitness requirements. This is evidence of the fact that it almost assuredly will, as many in the military predicted back when the change in policy was announced. But the larger and more important issue here isn't the physical fitness issue. It is the moral issue of putting women in combat. In a very short order, America has transformed itself from a nation that considered its responsibility as that of protecting women from combat to openly now recruiting women to go into combat. Though even many conservative and Christian commentators would point to this with alarm but decide to say nothing in public, the reality is that this is a very significant moral shift. It is at least on par with the issues of same-sex marriage and marijuana in terms of pointing to the larger moral shift that we are undergoing and currently experiencing as a culture. It is hand in hand with the secularization of the larger society, and that secularization alone can explain why so many of the different issues we are now confronting have come at us all at once, and how something like women in combat can come as something that would simply be unthinkable in America to something we now openly protect as a political goal. And so as this new year begins with so many huge issues looming before us, we keep in mind that biblical admonition, if you sow the wind, you reap the whirlwind. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.